Laughing Eyes Kennel presents The Gypsy Musher with Iditarod and Yukon Quest veteran Hugh Neff. The Gypsy Musher will share stories from the trail, fortune-telling, and memories of mushing years past. Follow The Gypsy Musher on Twitter and visit our website at gypsymusher.com.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and on the line, on the road, is the Gypsy Musher, Hugh Nephew. How are you doing?
Hey, man. Life is a highway, and I'm right there right now. We're just going past Harding Lake, heading towards Fairbanks.
I understand you have your good friend with you, Bruce. He's been with you for a couple of weeks. He's heading back to the States. What's going on with him? I know he and I are friends on Facebook, and he shared a lot of photos and videos of you guys over the last couple of weeks. How did he like Alaska?
Oh, he's had a great time, but he misses his wife and daughters, and I'm sure he's going to miss Alaska just as much once he's up in the air here in a few hours, heading back towards Spokane, but he'll be back in a few months. He's going to help handle for the Yukon Quest this year, so we're looking forward to that, but he's going back with a present as well. He's got a daughter named Holly, and now he's got a dog named Holly.
There you go. You know, you guys posted a video a week or so ago, with the Doors song, Riders on the Storm. It was a trip you guys took out on the sleds. Can you tell us a little bit about that trip?
Oh, man, life's always a trip, dude. But, it's been interesting. A lot of my mushing friends in Fairbanks and the interior area like to make fun of me for training dogs in tow, but up until this morning it's been 20 to 30 degrees warmer in tow, so I've been training maybe 10 below zero, but we have had quite a bit of wind, which has made it a little bit interesting as far as breaking in trail. But then of course I woke up this morning and it was 36 below zero, so we got a little bit of that Fairbanks weather, and to be honest, we're lucky to even be making it towards Fairbanks because it took a couple hours just to get my truck running this morning. But the beauty of Alaska is I had a neighbor who I've never even met before came by, and he's a mechanic, and he helped get the engine going for me, and so we're on our way. But yeah, that trip, all of our trips with Bruce have been great just because, as an experienced musher, I take a lot of what I do for granted, but I have more of a novice beginner musher out there on the trail with me. You can see the look of wonder in his eyes at how amazing these dogs really are and the energy that they have. Humans could never do what these canine athletes do, that's for sure.
That is so true, and I'm glad he was able to spend a couple of weeks with you and experience what's going on up there, because it is something special, and I have to agree with you 100%.
And the cool thing, too, is, Bruce is also a school teacher. He's taking the year off, and I've done numerous talks at his school outside of Spokane there, and I'm actually planning on going there towards the end of May at the end of my school tour. And that's the beauty of it, is he can share his adventures visiting me and being on the dog team with his students and his family. And that's what I really enjoy about mushing, is not just the fact that I get to have fun and do adventures and compete in races, but I get to share my stories with others, and that makes it that much more funner for me, especially to share, the beauty of my dogs. I think that's really where my career started doing better and started taking off, is when I worried more about my dogs becoming famous than me becoming well-known. And to have dogs like Annie and Walter, Maestro, known by lots of folks out there, that means more to me than what place I might come in some race.
So you said you're sending home a dog with Bruce when he heads back down to Washington. I believe you said her name was Holly. Can you tell us a little bit about that? A lot of people want to go out and adopt sled dogs when they're retired and things. Can you give some education to folks about that? I don't know how old Holly is. Maybe she's a pup. But what do you think about retired dogs going into people's homes after they're done?
I see no issue with that, as long as it's in a rural area. And if it's in a southern state, I would say a dog with less fur would help. Holly's going on 6 years old. She's a pooch that I got from Lester Earhart, who I used to work for up in Tanana. So she's a native Alaska Husky, and lots of energy, more of a sprint type of dog, a little bit houndier, not necessarily the style of dog that I prefer to race with. Tons of energy. She likes to cling to your arms all the time. She's very affectionate. And Bruce also has a few other Huskies that she'll be able to play with. So I think that the major point that I would like to make, if you're going to have a Husky or almost any style of dog, unless you're living in, you know, an urban city area, make sure they have friends to live with. I mean, these are social animals. There's nothing sadder than seeing a dog by themselves. They like to play with, you know, other critters of their ilk. So if I would say anything, you're going to get a dog from Alaska and you live in a rural area, make sure, first of all, that you're going to be able to give that dog plenty of exercise and attention, and make sure they have a playmate, too. Not just a human either, but another fur ball to play with.
Do retired sled dogs or dogs that have run, you know, most of their lives on a sled team do well in a housing type environment with families and kids and things, or are they best, you know, what I'm trying to say, are they best doing what they do versus being the house pet?
Well, I actually know a lot of women that won't even take a male dog because you know how boys like to mark their territory. And, of course, Bruce's wife, this will be their third, I believe, female dog, and then they have one boy dog. So, yeah, if you don't have, like, a backyard or somewhere, you know, to make sure that dog gets plenty of space and exercise, then definitely not, you know, these aren't animals that are suited for apartment settings. But I know folks like Joy Davis, and there's numerous folks throughout, you know, the lower 48 and around the world, I guess, that do adopt out animals and, you know, make little backyard play areas for them. And they really give them tons of attention and a lot of heart. And it's a beautiful thing. I mean, it's pretty special that folks are willing to take an animal at an older age and share their time with them. Because, you know, everybody wants to have a puppy, but all puppies turn into dogs sooner or later. And I think true dog lovers see the big picture when acquiring an animal. And just because a dog might have a few years on it doesn't necessarily make it any less beautiful than a puppy, that's for sure.
You know, Hugh, you were talking a few minutes ago about the weather conditions up in Fairbanks being below zero and things. Do you have any concerns with Bruce and the dog flying back at that temperature? I know that sometimes they have restrictions on that, you know, how long they can stay at a particular temperature at the airport. Is that a problem today?
No, it's actually a balmy 20 below here, Fairbanks. But, you know, they keep the cargo area in the plane. They keep that at a certain temperature so it doesn't get too cold for the animals. And the kennel has, like, a little carpeting for it, so Holly will be nice and comfy. In fact, she's right behind us in the back seat, crashed out. She's been trying to get up in the front seat, but she finally mellowed out after a couple hours on the road. Funny thing about the north, and I'm sure you're aware of this, Robert, is when it's beautiful out, when the sun's out, you have blue skies, that means it's usually pretty cold out. So right now, as I'm a few miles outside of Fairbanks, going through Salcha now, it's just a gorgeous day. The golden rays of the sun are shimmering off the snow-laden spruce trees. Sound like I'm writing. But that's wonderful, but it also means cold, and that's why
right.
It's a little bit nippy. That being said, when it's warmer out, that means it's usually more dangerous, actually. It's going to be cloudy out. You're going to have slicker streets to drive on. It's actually a little bit safer when it's about 10 to 20 below right in there. And I've been, you know, traveling all over the north and seeing a lot of different weather a lot of different villages or what have you, and I really think that dogs prefer 10 below to 10 above. I really think I've, you know, been running the dogs last week pretty good, so I know I was going to be giving them a couple days off here, and I think they're just thriving in the 10 to 15 below. And the other part of the trip I'm making right now is I'm actually going to get my next visitor, Jesse Holmes, who we will be heading to Eagle next week. So I'm really looking forward to that adventure. And after I drop Bruce off at the airport, before I get Jesse, I'm actually running down to Nanana real quick to acquire a few dogs that have been sent there for me from a fellow named John Baker or something like that. So I'm really looking forward to seeing those dogs from Costaview. And I tell you what, man, my life is not only nomadic, but pretty chaotic. It's a lot of stuff going on all at once, but, you know, the passion keeps you going, and if anything, it's hard for me to mellow out at all because I just have a lot on the table right now.
So we're talking to Hugh Neff, Iditarod and Yukon Quest veteran, and also the Gypsy Musher. He's calling in from the road heading to Fairbanks from Tok at about negative 20 or so on the road. And if we do lose him here, it's because of cell phone service. Don't worry about it. He'll call back in when he can. So, Hugh, you mentioned you're heading down to Nenana after you drop off your friend Bruce. I was up there last February for the start of the Serum Run, and I tell you, that was really my first taste of an Alaskan winter with, you know, 50-mile-an-hour winds, and you couldn't see further than the front of your sled. That is the beginning of village life in Alaska. It's right off the road system, but as you leave there out on the Serum Run Trail or Iditarod Trail, you start to hit a lot of these villages like Galena and so on and so forth. And I know you wanted to talk about village life today. What do you want to say about how these folks live out in the bush?
Hey, I don't care if you've won the Iditarod or if you've won a bunch of races. If you haven't been out and done some village racing, then you haven't seen Alaska. And that's why I thrive, and I can't wait to go up the Eagle. Never done that except for in the Quest, so it's going to be cool to go visit my buddy Wayne Hall up there. Let him show me his area, just a gorgeous part of Alaska. And then in a couple of weeks, Jesse and I are going to be heading up to Tanana, which I make a pilgrimage to every year from Manly. And there's many reasons why I like to go to Tanana. The Earhart family means a lot to me. And Brent Sass, the great kid, good buddy of mine, real good spirit for this sport. And the beauty of going to Tanana is there's two hot springs in the Manly area, which I always enjoy checking out. So village life, I was talking with another great musher who's really you know, one of the formidable foes as far as racing goes in the next few years. And people talk a lot about Dallas Seavey, and he deserves a lot of attention. But the other kid who's his age is really good is a guy named Pete Kaiser from Bethel area. And Pete and I were chatting on Facebook a few months back, and I was telling Pete, man, I wish you guys would come and do the Quest. Quest could really use some, you know, village mushers. We have Josh Cazzo. He's been great, but be nice to see some more natives get involved with the Quest. And Pete said, you know, it's pretty tough to come to the village. And I said to Pete, you know, you can always live on the highway system where you can race more. Pete just said right away, he said, I'll never leave the bush. It's a tough lifestyle living in the bush. It's expensive. The weather can be rough. Bethel weather, there's nothing like that in Alaska. It's always rough, it seems like. But there's a specialness to the bush life as well. And that's why I can't wait to do races like the Cusco in January and go up to Costaview in April for that race. So the villages are really what I believe Alaska is all about. A lot of folks down in the lower 48, they watch all these reality TV shows, and they get a glimpse of what it might be like in Unalakleet or some of the coastal villages. But until you're actually there, you don't realize that you really are in a very special part of this earth.
You know, Hugh, just yesterday they had an article in the Alaska Dispatch about village life and Thanksgiving turkeys, and they were talking about to get a turkey out to the village, it can cost upwards to $100 to $150 because they have to fly, you know, from Fred Meyer's to Bethel or wherever. So it is very expensive. Can you talk a little bit about that, about the expense of living in the bush? I know gas and oil are at a premium up there, and that's why a lot of people still ride on snow machines because it's just too expensive to do anything else. Can you paint a picture a little bit about the expense and how difficult it is to live in one of these remote villages?
Yeah, people don't realize that this economy has really affected the family system of the rivers and how you know, a lot of these village folks are all interrelated to each other, and it's a lot harder for them to go visit all the time because of the cost of fuel to go by, you know, to Ruby from Tanana or what have you, to go visit relatives or go by snow machine. So there really isn't as much traveling on the river, and that really has affected the Iditarod race because the trail isn't as heavily used, and it, so it could be a lot punchier. But, yeah, it's expensive out there just for a bag of dog food, another probably $5 a bag in freight, and that can be a little tough. That's why they tend to feed a lot more chum salmon in your villages. And, you know, it's a decision that the natives don't take lightly as far as leaving their home where their culture is and where their family is. And what I'm noticing lately in the last couple of years is a lot of the villages are going back to what they used to do in the early days of Iditarod or Fur Rondé or North American, and they're actually pooling dogs from the village together to make a super team. And I'll tell you what, man, when I first came up here, I remember going into the museum there in Nanana and looking at all the old Iditarod newspaper articles, and back in the day, it was only a couple of white guys and all natives racing. And then, you know, the last couple of decades, it turned into a rich man's sport, and it, I really think, took away from the spirit of what it was all about. So to see this revival of native mushers getting back into the sport, I mean, I think that's really what Joe Reddington's dream is all about. So he must have a big smile on his face, realizing that, you know, perseverance, life is tough up here in the north, but you just have to, you know, if you have to buy extra dog food, if it costs a little bit more, then that just means you're going to have to be a little bit cheaper in the clothes you wear or what have you. And as far as Thanksgiving goes, I mean, turkey's turkey, but I'll take moose or caribou any day of the week over turkey, that's for sure.
So Hugh, what do you think about some of these village mushers, possibly some of these guys that are up and coming that may not be able to afford the expenses like a John Baker could or whatever? What advice would you have to those guys in terms of, you know, getting things in gear to run the Iditarod if they're living, you know, three flights away from, you know, the closest race, whether it be the Iditarod or the Rondé or something on the road system, so to speak? The big races, I guess.
There are a bunch of wannabes. I'm a wannabe native, to tell you the truth, but there's a lot of wannabe native mushers. And what they should do, I don't know if John would want me to say this, but I would say give John a call. He's a busy boy right now, John. He's doing a lot of good stuff for his people, you know, and there's a lot of other great Emmett Peters. There's a whole plethora of folks in the Bethel area that would help out. Byron Angstman, one that comes to mind. Guys that want to keep the sport healthy. So, you know, a lot of folks in Alaska are really independent. They don't want charity. But if you can somehow figure out a way to take any of what is given to you and maybe help your sponsor profit from your being on the trail, then why not go and try to find sponsors out there? There's plenty of huge native corporations that I'm sure would be wanting to help their culture thrive and survive, whether it's Doyon or there's a whole host of Nana and a bunch of other corporations on the coast. So I think it behooves those native corporations to support their people and, you know, invest in their culture through dog mushing.
You know, that's a good point that you brought up, Hugh. Being up here only for about a year and a half, I noticed in the newspaper and TV and other things that culture is a big deal up here in Alaska, especially for, you know, the natives and their corporations. And down in the States, they don't do that. They're you know, the only thing that we think about Native Americans down in the States right now, unfortunately, is gambling and casinos. But up here, they really thrive on promoting the culture up here. Why do you think that they do that here and not down in the States?
Oh, I'm not going to stereotype too much about that. I'm sure they're trying to down south. It all depends on the people. The beauty I found in a lot of the villages is a lot of the ladies through the radio station, like KOTZ and CopTV, they're trying to initiate programs to help the younger kids learn their language again. That was the coolest part of going to Canada and listening to Lester talk to some of his friends and his local language. And there's a beauty. It's a very intense language, a lot of long words. I could give you a few examples, like Nuchilawaya is actually the word for Canada, where it means where the rivers meet. Lester, or Natua, was always a word that I liked because it means hurry up. And I really enjoyed the native language. I wish I could learn it better, but I'm not that bright, I guess. I got enough problems learning my own language. But, yeah, it takes a community, like they always say, and it's up to the younger folk to keep their history of their people going. Because, you know, everything's getting commercialized nowadays, and everything's getting more uniform as far as the languages of the world go. But the uniqueness of the Athabascan language or the Koyukon or what have you is really, I consider to be the true beauty of Alaska. And that's why whenever I get a chance, I go out there and visit the natives in their villages, because it might not have Walmart or movie theaters or any of that, but they have beautiful crafts and going to a potlatch, a dance of any ceremonial type of event. It's pretty amazing to watch their dance troops get up there, and there's a great energy. And the beauty of natives is they're always smiling, and I think that's the beauty that we can all learn from.
Totally agree. And if we could just step back for just a second, Hugh, you mentioned about back in the day how a lot of the natives or the mushers that are living in the bush used to pool their dogs and run some of these races and beat the socks off of us white guys when we would come up there. I remember Doc Lombard used to say the same thing. Can you share some history about that? I know when we talked about starting this show, you really wanted to showcase some of the old school mushers like Lombard and Atla and those guys. Can you share a story about that, of how they used to just pool their dogs and just beat us to death?
Well, I'll tell you what. Let me pass by this car real quick.
All right.
I'll tell you what I've been doing every morning. I just got this book that I've had, and I let a neighbor friend named Ronnie borrow it. And the reason I did that is she's getting into limited sprint mushing. But it's a book. It's an older book, probably mid-70s, by a fellow named Bill Waldron, who's not a famous Iditarod musher, but he knows 90% more than any Iditarod musher I know. And it's just the whole history of dogs, going back to Cephala, and it has a beautiful section talking about all the famous dogs, talks about a lot of sprint mushing history, and talks, you know, Gareth Wright, George Atla, early Iditarod, so it talks about Reddington's famous dog named Romer. And that's hopefully... The sport's been so dominated by musher personalities, and I'm one of them, and I admit it and all that, but if we could just get back to talking about the dogs and really promoting individual dogs and their unique traits, like you're saying, like Huslia would always put, it would be an honor for the locals to give a dog to George Atla, who was known as the Huslia Hustler, and you know, for them to do good and come down and all that traveling they had to do just to get to the starting line and then to dominate the way he did. And then for George Atla to sell a dog to Lombard, Doc Lombard, and then for Doc Lombard to do well with George Atla's dog, even though he might have beat George Atla, I really think in the back of his mind, George Atla still felt proud because he knew that that dog, you know, came from his village. And that's why I'm totally honored to be able to receive dogs from guys like John Baker, because he's not just going to give a dog out to anybody, and I really thank him, and I'm very grateful that I have this opportunity to run these dogs, because they are a different type of dog. They're not your typical road system dog. They're a little bit, what we like to say, old school or like old village type. I remember talking with Lester Earhart a lot about it. And Lester would always say that dogs just aren't what they used to be like, and I could never figure out what he's talking about, but a lot of it had to do not with their speed or their power, but what they had upstairs in their mind. And like this dog that I have from John now, Sport and Gringo, that I already have, but they're great to hang out with. They're like total, I almost consider them equals as far as when we're out on the trail, they see as much and know as much as I do. It's just up to me as a musher to know and learn how they're communicating with me. And Ford's already going to be one of my main leaders. They're a pretty cool dog. I got him up there with Walter, who's like my own type of dog that I have reared through the years, who's a six-year-old now, and Sport's a little bit younger, but same size as Walter, and just the goofiness to him. He likes to, you know, mess with me as much as I like to play with him.
And like you said, you have to be honored when you get dogs from other folks. And, you know, I'm in that boat with you, Hugh. I got a couple of great dogs from you a couple of months ago in Sydney and Denali and Spencer. And I pretty much run those guys 3-4 days a week. And Denali and Sydney are my main leaders right now, and they're doing awesome. So I have to say that I am totally honored to have a couple of your guys running on my team. And I know exactly what you're saying there.
Yeah, Sydney's brother Nathan's one of my main leaders throughout the last 3-4 years. And Denali actually is, the lines of Denali go back to Susan Butcher, you know, and that's another cool part about going up to the Manly Hot Springs area. For me, besides visiting Brent, I get to go see where, you know, Rick Swenson and Susan Butcher used to train, and there's a lot of history in that area, so... It's not, you know, the fanciest place in the world, and there's not a lot of stores to go shopping and all that, but there's a lot of interior beauty up there, and I really love going up to that part of the interior each early summer. I was hoping this year, like going to Eagle next week, that I was going to beat the cold, but, you know, we've already had 40, 50 below in the interior, so Mother Nature, we're on her schedule as usual.
You know, Hugh, I just have one more point to make about village life and kind of the old school mushing. You know, today everybody thinks Iditarod, and that's what people talk about on social media and Facebook and things. How would you best sum up how we could bring people together to this history of this sport? Because it's not just about dogs. It is the way of life, and that's one of the reasons why we're doing this show is the Gypsy Musher is that way of life. What would you suggest people do instead of just constantly, you know, talking about Iditarod and, you know, the Super Bowl of the sport and going back to the old days and how much history is there?
Well, you know, you could always – they've drummed up Balto to be the super dog, even though a lot of us who are very read up on the history of the sport realize there's a lot of great dogs besides Balto. Just in the serum run alone, Togo – what that dog did was really phenomenal. I mean, but he wasn't there at the finish line, and that's why Balto got all the attention. Nothing against Balto or anything, but there were other great dogs in the serum run and great mushers as well besides Sevilla and Gunnar Cassis. But what I've been proposing for years, and, you know, most mushers are so into what they're doing with their dog that it's hard for the sport of mushing to get super organized. It's a beauty that we're able to do all we do in this sport with all the different personalities that we have. And
I think we might have lost Hugh there. Again, he's traveling to Fairbanks, and he's on the road today. As the Gypsy Musher, hopefully he will call right back in. But we're talking about village life and kind of the history of the sport of mushing. It's not always about the Iditarod. It's about that lifestyle that people live up here in the bush and off the highway, so to speak. And for people that don't understand, literally a mile from my house in Willow is the middle of nowhere. It's not like going down in the States where, you know, everything is located along the highway, and then there's you know, within an exit or two, there's more to come. But not up here. Cell phone service drops off, and, of course, internet and all those sorts of things. And it's truly a different lifestyle that many people in America do not understand. And I think that that's the key to this show, the Gypsy Musher, is talking about how we live up here as mushers and as a lifestyle versus, you know, something that we're forced to do or we're made to do. It's something that we've attracted ourselves to become part of something bigger than it is, which is the sport of mushing. So we're going to take a quick break. Hopefully Hugh comes back on. If he doesn't, we're going to end the show early, and we'll make sure that we get back on the air next week at the same time. So we're just going to play some out music here, and if he does call in, we'll bring him back up. Otherwise, just sit back and listen, and we will see you guys next week. Make sure to follow us, Gypsy Musher, on Twitter as well as Facebook under Dogworks Radio. This is Robert Forte. We'll be back real soon. Hugh back on the air. Hugh, are you there?
Hey, Robert. You still around?
We are still here. I was just summing up what we were talking about, played a couple of tracks of music there, hoping that you would call back. I said that you were on the road, so if we lose you, we'll make sure to get you back on. So let's carry on. We have about 13 minutes left of the show. We're talking about how to get people back more interested into the backstory of mushing, the history of mushing, and you were talking about what we need to do as a mushing community.
Like I was saying earlier, I don't know if you got caught what I was talking about, setting up some type of racing NASCAR type of point system for mushing throughout the year, I think would be really cool for the sport. As far as the history of the sport goes, I think a lot of that has to do with the mushers acknowledging where we came from. And, like, I go in Tok, there's a guy named Bill Arpino, who has a store there. He sells a lot of Alaska craft. And most folks don't know who Bill Arpino is, so you give that guy respect as much as any musher, because he came in 11th place in the first Iditarod. You know what? There wasn't much of a trail back then. So folks like that, those guys are a little bit more hardy as far as being true woodsmen and, you know, being able to survive the wrath of Mother Nature. A lot of the Iditarod nowadays is a little bit more commercialized, a lot nicer trail. Mother Nature can always act up, but usually it's a little bit easier than it was what those guys went through. That's why I think we have a different style of dog we're using nowadays. Back then, their dogs weren't as fast, but they were a little bit stockier and better at pulling, I would say.
Back then, they were still using Malamutes and some great big dogs to do that trail. Of course, they were doing it in well over 2 weeks, nothing like the speed records that John Baker ran last year, and, of course, Ramey Smith coming in a very quick second. Do you think that that's just like in NASCAR and other sports, it's just kind of the product of the system versus something that we want to adopt to?
Yeah, a lot of it has to do with just the medical care that we're getting nowadays with the dogs. The veterinarians are very great at helping us out, care for our teams. Food quality, trail maintenance has gotten better, of course. Not necessarily great all the time. I mean, some years Mother Nature can wipe out a trail in seconds. But competition, every year now there's probably 15 to 20 teams that could win the race, where back in the day there was only about maybe two or three mushers that dominated for years at a time. So I think that level of competition has spurred all of us as mushers to take this from a winter sport to a year-long lifestyle. And that's why I think you'll see races continue to thrive, because all of us as mushers individually want to get better. And we learn from the tricks of the trade. We see what John Baker or Jeff King or Martin Boozer or Lance or whoever, their little secrets, you know, in these videos. And that's how we can pick up our pace as well. And a lot of it has to do with just eliminating your own weaknesses as a musher. And because those small mistakes, they really add up when you're out on the trail. So you can learn to focus on not your strengths, but most importantly, your weaknesses and how to eliminate them. They're going to make you a better musher at the long run.
So back in the early days of the Iditarod, you know, early to mid-70s, how many guys and gals were running the race back then compared to now where we have 50, 60, 70 entries per year?
Okay, so the first race to Nome, there were 34 teams, I believe, from what Bill was telling me, and 22 teams finished. He came in 11th, and I don't know, I put this lightly, but every story you hear in the history of dog mushing isn't exactly probably how it happened out there on the trail. So only the folks that were actually there really know what went down. There were a few media back in the day, but nothing like the, you know, helicopters and snow machines and planes nowadays where it's a literal, you know, Mardi Gras out there with lots of folks checking out the scene. So back then, we don't really know what the secrets of the trail were. Where nowadays, it's a little bit easier to see if a guy makes a big run or maybe if somebody had to carry a dog in their bag and slow them down. We can sort of pick that up by what we see on the internet or in the paperwork that we're allowed to read at checkpoints. But yeah, I go back to books and I'll read an old Team and Trail or an old mushing magazine. And there are there's a certain wisdom of dog mushing that is lasts forever throughout the decades, and that's what I'm trying to pick up. Like yesterday morning, I was reading that Bill Baldwin book I was talking about earlier, called Alaska Sled Dog, and he just talked about, you know, bonding with your dogs and getting them out of their comfort zone, and you know, that's exactly what I'm doing nowadays by taking the dogs and going on a big trip to Eagle or going to Tanana, because I'm letting the dogs learn for themselves through experience. And it's fun for me because I'm going to go on this trip, and I know who my group dogs are, but I'm going to learn about some of my other dogs that I don't really realize just yet how great they are, but they're going to shine by overcoming, you know, maybe being a little bit tired or maybe we'll see some weather on the trail. And that's how you really learn whether you have a solid dog. And that's how you create a solid dog team, is by, you know, you got to challenge yourself every once in a while.
Speaking of solid dogs, we have about 7 minutes left, Hugh. You want to talk about one of your dogs in the profile this week, Tyler. Let's talk about Tyler.
Okay. The reason I chose Tyler, he's Delilah's brother, Omen's son. Very special dog, close to my heart. Shy dog, got the little speckles in his eye, which is a throwback to the Gareth Ryder or a Husky line. What makes Tyler special to me is I used to Glacier, I don't know, about 7 years ago now, down in Seward, where the Seabees have their big operation. And I did a show there with Jeff Corwin called Inside Alaska, I believe. But anyways, one time, this little boy came up with his parents to go on a ride, and Tyler wasn't even alive at the time. Tyler's only 5 now, but the boy who came up on the sled dog ride on the glacier that summer, his name was Tyler, and he actually had cystic fibrosis, and I think he passed on now. But it was a very humbling experience to see the happiness that that boy had. And he was full of vigor, and he was a kid living life and dealing with a tough reality. And to see the sadness in his parents' face, you know, dealing with such a tough situation, it was really sort of heart-wrenching. But his spirit, you know, lives through one of my lead dogs now. And pretty amazing dog. Done a lot of quests, and I did her eyes. He's only a 5-year-old now. I think he's already done 6,000 milers. Gave him the year off in lead last year because the girls were just on fire last year. But I've been running him back in lead again this year, and he's doing great. and he and all his brothers and sister, they're all pure white dogs, and they're fun to watch because they got them loose in the pen. They're all playing with each other, and a lot of love within that group, and I have a feeling they're going to really shine this year. They're really trail-hardened, and they're very tough, so a 100-mile run to them, nothing.
So as Hugh says all the time, you're not a fan of Laughing Eyes Kennel or the Gypsy Musher unless you know his dogs. And every week we talk about some of his super dogs. We've talked about Delilah and Tyler and Jewel as we're going on in this show. Hugh, we have a couple of minutes left. Anything else you want to mention?
Well, believe it or not, as we finish the show off, I am driving by the Santa Claus house in North Pole, Alaska. So first and foremost, I wish everybody a happy holidays. Looking forward to spending Thanksgiving up in Eagle next week. And go Bears. The Packers are looking good, but don't forget the Bears.
There you go. So next week we'll do our best to have our show on at some point. I know he's going to be up in Hugh's going to be up in Eagle. So we're going to show in at some point next week because people are just dying to hear it. I get messages all the time on my Facebook wall and in my message box about how they listen to the Gypsy Musher. So it's really catching on fast. So I'm sure Hugh gets plenty of messages in his box as well. So it's turned into something pretty big, Hugh, and I'm pretty thankful to be part of this, and I think that you've really got something good going on here. What do you think?
It sounds great, dude, and we're definitely going to be doing a show next week from the Yukon River, and maybe I'll even try to get my buddy Wayne to chime in as well. Wayne Hall's another one of these guys that you might not hear a lot about him in the Iditarod, but he's one heck of a dog, man, and I'm sure I'm going to have one heck of a story. It's about a 150-mile run we're going to be doing here next week just to get to Eagle. We're going to hang out there for a few days and then come back, so I'm pretty pumped about that.
So I'm looking forward to it, and we'll definitely talk next week. And me and you will remain in contact, as always, through Facebook or whatever. So, Hugh, be safe out there. Tell Bruce good travels. I'm sure I'll talk to him as well soon on Facebook, and we'll see you soon, okay?
All right, man. Peace to everybody out in Internet Land.
Take care. This is Robert Forto for our co-host on the Gypsy Musher, Hugh Neff. You can follow him on Facebook at Dogworks Radio or search Hugh Neff in the search bar, as well as on Twitter, Gypsy Musher. At Gypsy Musher is the Twitter feed, and very soon we will have the website, gypsymusher.com. So, till next time, never forget your dreams. This is Robert Forto for Hugh Neff, the Gypsy Musher. Talk to you soon. Goodbye.